Good morning, everyone. Today is September 17th, 2024, and it's the fourth full day of our seven-day retreat. Yesterday, I spoke a little bit about bodhisattvas, specifically Manjushri, in the context of Master Gute and his finger. And bodhisattvas are beings who have studied and practiced in such a way that they have transformed their suffering. And they no longer need to project their suffering out into the world. Instead, they transmit the reality of their true nature, which is also our true nature. They transmit fearlessness and freedom. They are wide open, spacious. And they don't just stay on their cushions, blissed out, in deepest samadhi. They choose instead to stay engaged with life, exactly as it is. They make friends with life, with all of life. There are countless and innumerable bodhisattvas, and some of them are very, very well known, and some are very obscure. And they all share the aspiration, the commitment to be fully present in order to relieve suffering. So there's our friend Manjushri, who we met briefly yesterday. Manjushri is traditionally depicted as a beautiful young man seated on a roaring lion with a sword in his hand. He is the bodhisattva of wisdom, of understanding, and he uses that sword to cut through ignorance. There is Avalokiteshvara, known in Chinese as Kuan Yin, the one who hears the cries of the world. In ancient India, Avalokiteshvara appeared in the form of a man. But by the time Buddhism reached China, he had become a woman. In a way, this kind of makes sense, because how can compassion be defined by gender? So he, she, they, Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, are the bodhisattva of great compassion. They possess the ability to be with suffering just as it is, without getting lost in it, without pushing it away. And Kuan Yin, in her female form, graces our altar here on retreat. And just a little bit about compassion. We often think of compassion as being very soft, very embracing, something that cradles suffering, like the healing balm that is pouring out of the vessel in their hand. But sometimes compassion can be fierce. Sometimes compassion says, okay, that is enough, no more, in order to protect and alleviate the suffering that is present right at that moment, skillfully. And we can only know in that moment, what skillful means can we use to relieve suffering. There's Kasitigarbha, Jizo in Japanese, and he is the bodhisattva of the great vow, of the hell realms, of perseverance. She never abandons anyone, no matter how difficult, how hopeless the suffering may appear. So these bodhisattvas and countless others manifest energies, qualities that exist in each one of us. You know, we all have the capacity to awaken. We all have the capacity to understand, not just intellectually, but intrinsically, innately, down onto a cellular level, you know, that we are not separate and never have been. You know, because of that, you know, we understand that suffering in any form affects all of us, you know, affects the life of the world. All of us here right now are bodhisattvas in training. Life, our own particular life, you know, is constantly offering us lessons, the opportunity to be present with ourselves, exactly as we are. And, you know, and to be present with life, exactly as it is. And from that place of acceptance, of equanimity, you know, we can choose how to respond to the suffering we encounter. And we don't have to be perfect. It's okay to make mistakes. We take refuge in our aspiration to help release suffering. And then we pick ourselves up and we start all over again. Sometimes it feels like we are carrying the heavy burden of our suffering all the time. And we may feel isolated and alone. But what if we could shift our perspective just a little to see that life really is supporting us? Despite our difficulties, or perhaps even through our difficulties. If we are all bodhisattvas in training, maybe everyone and everything are also training in bodhisattvas, you know, just at different stages on the path. Perhaps waking up really isn't an individual matter at all, you know, that we are all constantly creating the causes and conditions that allow all of us, everything, to awaken. Can we possibly see Donald Trump as a bodhisattva in training? Now, I know that might be a stretch, but Donald Trump has taught me a lot about anger, fear, and hatred, about where anger lives in me, how hatred lives in me, how fear arises in me. Today we'll take up the second, third, and fourth realizations of great beings, although not in that particular order. The third realization is the awareness that the human mind is always searching outside itself and never feels fulfilled. So I think by now, on our fourth day of retreat, we've all had a chance to see this very personally, very intimately in our own minds. And, you know, and that's really wonderful. That means we've been paying attention. That means that we have been practicing. And it's very liberating to know that this is how the human mind works. So it's nothing personal about us. It doesn't mean we have a bad practice or there's something wrong with me and my brain and the way I am in the world. It's how we as humans are. So we can just put away the judgment and just stop blaming. And already we feel a little lighter, a little freer. You know, the reality is that life isn't the way we want it to be. You know, for one thing, everything is constantly changing, which, you know, we think is really great when we're unhappy and we hope things change really soon. But it really sucks when we're in the happy period of our life and we want things to be just the way they are. And, you know, even when we are happy, we want more happiness. You know, maybe we have scrimped and saved, and we were planning to go on this big trip, this trip of a lifetime. You know, we have made plans. We got the time off from work, which is a little miracle in itself. We packed our bags. We made the reservations, and we're off to Bali, or Paris, or Tikal in the Guatemalan rainforest. It doesn't matter. It's someplace we've always really wanted to go to. And so we get there. We travel long distances, you know, long flights. We go through security, you know, we're tired. And we finally get to this place that we have dreamed of. And, you know, it's nothing like we thought it would be. And, you know, we really miss our dog. And all that beauty and all that wonder just is not enough for us to be happy at that moment. You know, or let's say that we're a homebody and we know this about ourselves, and we're happy to stay at home, to work in our garden, to hang out with friends. And everything is lovely. The sun is shining. We feel great. But our partner, who loves us dearly and wanted to help us, went to the store, did the shopping, and brought the wrong kind of coffee and some weird flavored coffee creamer instead of the half and half that we really like. And now we're stuck with this, at least for this morning, and we don't like it one bit. You know, there are times in our lives when we touch huge sorrows, disappointments, heartbreaks. No one is immune from that. And at the same time, and in the same way, there are the daily petty little things that cause dissatisfaction. Such is the nature of our mind. The second realization of great beings is the awareness that more desire brings more suffering. All hardships in daily life arise from greed and desire. We've already seen how our mind is not at rest, searching outside itself, never satisfied. So combine that with wanting more, always wanting more, and we have the perfect recipe for suffering. We live in a society that values material consumption, that equates wealth and power with success, with some type of moral superiority over other people. We have all seen how that leads to destruction. The destruction of our natural world, the lives of beings, both animate and inanimate, are seen as resources to be used up to meet needs. The destruction of civil discourse, the inability to see others' viewpoints as valid, creating that divide of self and other, right and wrong, diminishing, demeaning, dehumanizing. The destruction of our own inner lives, our relationship to ourselves, not having the time or energy to follow our own heart. And please know that I imply no judgment whatsoever. Now, I live in the world. I have a job. I work very long hours, and my work schedule is truly grueling. There are times when I feel exhausted to the very core of my being. And I do know how to take care of myself, you know, physically, emotionally, spiritually. But sometimes I simply can't. Sometimes there aren't enough hours in the day. Sometimes I think, you know, as a bodhisattva in training, my name should be bodhisattva just barely hanging on. And I don't think I'm alone. You know, our dissatisfaction, our wanting more, you know, these leads to conditions of suffering, you know, in ourselves and in the world. Even when we see this and we want to change, to stop it, you know, it can be hard to step out and break these cycles. But it's not impossible. Our practice, by nature, is subversive. In a world that says, go, 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 our practice tells us to stop and just breathe. In a world that teaches that resources are scarce and must be controlled, and we go to war trying to control those resources, our practice shows us tangibly that we are enough, that this moment is enough. Sitting in meditation is an extremely active, dynamic process. It informs, colors, and shapes our lives in many, you know, and sometimes mysterious ways. Coming back to the breath, this breath, and this breath, and just this breath. Not fixing, not changing, just being. Little by little, we begin to see what's really happening inside ourselves. What thoughts arise, what emotions we feel, where we get caught, where we get carried away, where we contract and close down. It takes a sense of adventure to practice this way. It takes curiosity and courage to see us, to see ourselves as we really are. And a sense of humor can be really helpful as well. And when the busyness of our mind fades away, as it will when we sit, and we can begin to touch stillness, spaces open up between the thoughts and emotions and sensations. In those still places, deep within, deep, deep within our mind, so deep, you know, that we are sometimes barely even aware of them. You know, we can begin to perceive those very quiet voices whispering stories to ourselves about who we are, about who we should be. These stories have been around for a very, very long time. We might have inherited them from our parents and grandparents and beyond. And we may have elaborated them ourselves, so they have gotten stronger and they seem very solid and stable and real. But really, they're not real. We believe them to be so, we allow them to be so. We allow them to rule our lives, but they are just stories. We might find ourselves repeating patterns of behavior over and over. Different circumstances, but the same way of acting, of being in the world. An old friend of mine told me about his life and his practice and how the two are intertwined. So my friend, he just really wanted to be in a relationship, a strong, stable, long-term relationship. He just really wanted to be loved that way. To have that sense of security, that he was not alone, that someone really cared for him. And he, of course, had formed a number of relationships, but they all seemed to end badly, even though all the people he was involved with were really quite different. And there came a time when he fell in love again, and he was certain that this was it, this was the one. And he was very happy. But after a couple years, that relationship ended too. And he was just brokenhearted. Disillusioned, really dejected. He felt like a failure. And there wasn't something he really wanted to talk about, because it wasn't okay, you know, especially as a man, to talk about your broken heart and feeling rejected and disillusioned. But he was a practitioner. He was already a practitioner, and he really wanted to find a different way going forward. And he was tired of the drama and of the chaos, and he just wanted to understand the suffering that he was experiencing. So he took himself in hand and really just gave himself to practice. He started going on lots of retreats as often as he could, just spending more time with Sangha. And he began to really pay attention to when he was present and when he was not. He began to notice what pulled him away from just being present. And he began, with time, to notice a pattern of thoughts and emotions rising over and over and over in him. He said that these thoughts, these emotions, were really strong, and they would carry him very far away from the present moment. And there were thoughts like, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, there's something wrong with me. That's why no one will ever really love me. He said he couldn't resist these stories he told himself about why he was this way. And they were so strong, he could spend a whole period of meditation or longer just in these thoughts. And he said sometimes, you know, just the opposite would happen. Sometimes these thoughts would arise, and instead of telling the story, he would begin to feel like really anxious, really restless. Like he could barely sit still, and his mind got very busy. And he would start making lists internally of like all the things he needed to do. Like at the end of the retreat, I need to go to the store and buy milk and do this. And he had a long, long list, and he would recite the list of all the things he needed to do. All the things he needed to do in order to not be present right now. But you know, he practiced really well, you know, coming back as best he could, over and over and over again. And by doing that, he did begin to create a lot of space within. He said there came a time when he could more easily be with just whatever it was that was arising. There came a time when he could hear the voice, the little voice whispering, "You're just not good enough. You know, everyone knows it. That's why you're alone." You know, those thoughts of unworthiness, of being unlovable. And he found that he no longer needed to tell the story. He could simply feel the emotion that the stories held for him. The shame he felt that he could never, and that he could never ever express. The fear of being found out. He could simply feel the loneliness that filled his heart. Without having to tell himself the story, without getting lost or shutting down, he could just be. And he said when that happened, he could feel his heart burst open, and there were times he would just cry on his cushion. And then he could hold himself, his fear, his shame. He could hold that with love. He could hold it with a compassion that was like a healing balm, that was gentle and freeing. And he had broken through the prison of his thoughts. And he continued to practice. And over the course of months and then years, his sitting became much more peaceful, more concentrated. And there were times when those thoughts and emotions about not being enough, not being loved or lovable, would return. But he knew now that those were just thoughts, just emotions, and they no longer had the power to hurt him the way they had before. And he said sometimes he would still get caught, but he knew how to let it go. Now, Dogen Zenji, the great 13th century Japanese Zen master, was once asked about practice, and this is his very famous response, and we've probably all heard this a thousand times, but it's so beautiful and so true that I will say it once more. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to let go of the self. To let go of the self is to be one with the 10,000 myriad things. You know, transformation does occur on the cushion through still, focused, one point of concentration. We don't chase our story trying to understand it. We also don't push it away. We simply come back as best we can to our breath, to life as it is, to who we are right now. When that little miracle happens, when through practice we heal an ancient wound, we become more available, more open, less reactive. The transformation in ourselves allows for transformation in the world. This is a very important step in practice, but it's not the end of practice. In fact, it's just the beginning. You know, we vow to save all beings, to abandon greed, hatred, and ignorance, to wake to life just as it is, to embody the Buddha's way, which is our own way, through our own perfectly flawed and unique life. And we can only do this right now. The only time we have is right now. In this moment, only now. And with gratitude, with humility, with courage, we walk the ancient path. And we have to do it our own way. But we are never alone. You know, right now, the birds, the trees, the wind, the banging of the blinds and the window pane, the waves, they're all here for us. All our ancestors, our descendants, the many beings known and unknown alive with us at this moment are practicing with us right now. You know, we need our practice. And the world needs us to practice. The world is practicing with us at this very moment in many different forms, in forms that are beautiful and easily accessible and easily open our hearts, and in forms that we simply cannot understand how could this be happening. And we may not approve of it. In fact, we may hate it. But it calls to us as well, open your heart. Come back. You are not separate even from this, that which you hate, that which you fear. In practice, we learn to find the way to hold all of that with open hands and open hearts and no expectations that things will be how we want them to be. But we can trust our intention to not harm. We can trust our aspiration to be present with suffering in all the forms we encounter, including our own, our confusion, our fear, our despair. And from that place of stillness within us, of not judging, of not reacting, we can offer the best of who we are. And we don't know how that will play out. And that's okay. All we have is this moment. And that is enough. We are enough. So as we continue on this great journey of practice together this week, and this great journey, which is our life at this moment, filled with many, many questions, and we have this amazing luxury of being in a beautiful place where we are safe and protected, where we have delicious food, and soft, sort of soft beds, and central heat, and everything we need to be alive and okay. So let's really be aware of that and enjoy it and relish it. Let's take good care of each other and take good care of our practice together. And with all of life, with every being, step by step, breath by breath, moment by moment, you know, we walk together into the vast unknown.